Welcome to The Fighting Priests, a podcast exploring orthodoxy and jiu-jitsu, two paths, one struggle. Father Ted Paraskevopoulos and Father Thomas Sandberg are two orthodox Christian priests who also happen to be practitioners of jiu-jitsu. Together, they explore how these two unique worlds intersect and what it means for our spirituality. Here's Father Ted and Father Thomas. Welcome, everybody, back to The Fighting Priests. My name is Father Ted Paraskevopoulos with my co-host, Father Thomas Sandberg. Father Thomas, how's it going?
Going good. Yourself?
Good. Yeah, we're here with our 24th episode here in the new year, 2021. And today we are blessed to have another guest from the States and actually from San Francisco. Well, close to San Francisco, I believe.
Yeah, just outside.
Just outside San Francisco. Everyone's just outside. So one of the big kids.
East Bay.
For those of you who are following our episodes last week, last 2 weeks actually, we had on our show Denny Prokopos from the San Francisco Jiu-Jitsu Academy, and today we have one of his purple belts, I believe purple belts, Pavlik, who is of Russian Orthodox descent. And he studies under and trains under Denny Prokopos. And he'll tell us a little bit more about his story. But Greg, we're very happy to have you on.
Great. Glad to be here.
Wonderful.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah, yeah. We're really excited. Like, we're, you know, most of our guests are actually from the States. So it's kind of strange. Not a lot from Canada. And, but that's okay. And, but now we're branching into the West Coast. So, you know, Denny was the first one from the West Coast, and you're the second, and hopefully there'll be many more. So we're excited.
Yeah. Well, we got a lot of jiu-jitsu out here in California for sure. And we got a lot of Orthodox as well. So there's some intersection points.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. We're looking to bring all the Orthodox who do jiu-jitsu out of the woodwork. That's the whole podcast. So, we didn't know there were that many, to tell you the truth. So
we're very excited. Yeah, I think so. You know, jiu-jitsu has exploded in popularity. I can't say orthodoxy has exploded in the same level, but there's certainly, California's always got people coming from all over the world. So we have an infusion of orthodox peoples. The parish we're at has large Georgian community, some Russians, a lot of regular Americans as well.
Sure. So you're just outside of San Francisco, you said?
Yeah, I'm on the East Bay. A town called Danville. So the main place that I train is 10th Planet Walnut Creek, which is maybe 30 minutes from San Francisco.
Okay.
And I think I'm correct. My coach there, the owner at 10th Planet Walnut Creek, is a guy named Alex Canders, and I believe he was Denny's first black belt.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. And you're a purple belt, you said?
I am, yes. 5 years of purple belt now, I think.
Oh, wow.
been at it for a long time.
Any degrees on the belt?
We don't really do the degrees, you know, because the 10th Planet stuff is...
Oh, yeah.
So I think the belts are kind of a useful way to keep track of progression and for competition reasons. Although a lot of the no-gi tournaments, candidly, they'll be beginner, intermediate, you know, expert type of divisions rather than even by belt there. So purple belts, brown belts, black belts kind of get lumped up in one area.
Okay. That's interesting. Nice.
Not always, but sometimes.
Very nice. Nice. Well, we look forward to hearing your story.
All right, Greg. Well, thanks for coming on today. Looking forward to this. So why don't you tell me and tell our listeners a little bit about your background and a little bit about your journey, I guess.
So you want the Orthodox journey or the Jiu-Jitsu journey? Or
Orthodox journey first.
The Orthodox.
Yeah.
Probably somewhat unusual. I do have, my paternal background was Russian Orthodox. Most of the family was from the Transcarpathian region in Eastern Europe. So sort of on the borderlands of the Russian Empire, partially some of what's in modern Ukraine, some I think is on the far east of Slovakia. So I kind of, from my dad's side, I grew up seeing a lot of traditions associated with the Orthodox Church. So we would go to my great-grandmother's up in the Pennsylvania coal country for quote-unquote Russian Easter. And there's always like a big traditional dinner there, and family would come from all over. My grandparents were quite close with us as a family. We're kind of blessed to have really just kind and very family oriented surroundings there. And they would do a tradition called Holy Supper, which is at least an Eastern European tradition. It's kind of a vegan meal that goes in stages. There's soups and there's cabbage, lots of cabbage stuff. My wife, whose background is more Western European, first time she came over, she said, "What is all this cabbage stuff? All you guys are eating is cabbage and beans. You know, is this, how do you make it through the night? Does everybody wind up just, you know, gassy? And this is what happens on Christmas morning." But we, you know, we kept those traditions in the family. But my mom's background is German and English and in a more kind of Protestant orientation. So I was not raised in the church, kind of more of a, what I call maybe a generic Protestant background was exposed to and raised in. But as I got older, I was very interested in science and philosophy and that form, I guess, at least of and those branches of Protestant Christianity seemed very not very friendly to science. You know, lots of opposition to evolution, the idea that the earth is old, things that just seemed a bit odd to me at the time. And so as I got older and got more in depth in terms of studying sciences, and my academic background originally was in the hard sciences. I got interested in the questions, the big questions in life, and did a lot of academic study in philosophy and intellectual history. But I kind of moved fairly sharply away from religion in general, to the point where I was, went through kind of a self-identified agnostic phase to more of a philosophical atheism, which is kind of where I stayed for better part of two decades, from my 20s till about 40. Not always hostile to religion, but sometimes, fairly antagonistic.
Yeah.
Much to my wife's chagrin, I'm sure my parents' chagrin. But I had... I think it was maybe in the late 2000s, there was a spate of books that came out from the so-called new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett. And, for me at the time, I was busy with work and worried about other things, but these books came out and I was like, aha, finally, there's a cultural moment that I can embrace and, even kind of evangelize. I bought a bunch of these books and generally was pretty, excited about the prospects of having kind of a popular moment for a non-religious point of view. And the books were not good, I guess the way I would put it. And because I had had a formal training in philosophy, I was going to do my PhD in philosophy, actually, in either metaphysics or philosophy of mind. I dropped out, didn't matriculate in the program because I couldn't afford it, but it was a strong interest of mine. The books, I knew enough about philosophy, and also, a lot of the traditional arguments, that revolved around, you may call natural theology and metaphysics, to realize that these books were actually quite bad. So for example, that there's an idea in I think, well, probably all mature theistic traditions, of divine simplicity.
Yeah.
That, there's an essential unity, in the Godhead, and that, it's simple, quote unquote, simple, undivided, not composed of parts. Dawkins in The God Delusion dedicates a whole chapter to explain why God couldn't exist, because for something that complex, it would be impossible not to have an evolutionary process to develop it, or something along these lines.
So I think David Bentley Hart addresses that in an article on First Things, that exact argument. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy because it's not even a straw man that he sets up. I mean, he completely misunderstands the basic concepts, and then goes on to compose an argument centralized around this misunderstanding. So for me, that was a, you know, just because somebody makes a bad argument, it's not a proof one way or the other. But it was kind of a moment of rethinking, like if these are, and these aren't smart, these are smart guys. I mean, I've read most of Dawkins' books, or had read even prior to that, his books on evolutionary theory. And for the most part, they're quite good. I mean, they're, you know, there's equivocations on that, but his books on, you know, fundamentals of biology and evolutionary development are reasonably good books and, you know, accessible to a general audience. So he's clearly an intelligent man, as were all the other, you know, Hitchens and Dennett and so forth. They're not, you know, stupid people, but they seem to be willfully obtuse and made incredibly bad arguments. So that kind of gave me pause. And at the same time, you know, around the same time period, a lot of things going on in my personal life. And I had, I think it was like Barnes and Nobles had picked up a Penguin book on the Apostolic Fathers. And just, I like to read, you know, all kinds of topics. Even, I especially like to read things I don't agree with. So yeah. That yeah. Kind of fed into it.
Very important, and not everyone does that. I think it's very important to do that.
Well, you want to challenge yourself, right? And there's no doubt we all live with a lot of misconceptions about things. And I was struck at the time just how different that picture of early Christianity was from what I had been exposed to with a lot of this more, you might call, fundamentalist type Protestantism. So I kind of was struck by how different it was and how, from my vantage point then, having grown up largely in a South Jersey, was kind of a Catholic community, how much more it looked like Catholicism. So that was like, I was like, you know, this is interesting. And I just finished that book up, and we were in doing a family trip to Italy and traveling around Italy. And so, of course, when you're in Italy, you're looking at, you know, art and churches and relics and all this stuff that goes back in history to, you know, the first millennia and then to the first century. So it struck me, that really resonated with what I saw in the Apostolic Fathers. And while we were on that trip, I happened to be rereading, Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, cause you know, you're on a lot of plane time and trains and so forth. So, I was digesting, Karamazov, and frankly, on a rereading, the book was much more, I was able to absorb a lot more of it reading it the second or third time than I did the first time around. And, you know, Dostoevsky's got this fascinating take on things in general, right? He makes arguments not for a specific point of view, but he tries to make the strongest arguments for every point of view, right? So I think they call it polyphonic literature. So he, in Karamazov, he's putting out this portrait of nihilism and atheism, but then he counterposes that, and the arguments that are made, like say, against the existence of God, against goodness, with something that struck me as really unique and compelling, because it reflected, I think, some of my experiences I had just personally in life. And instead of trying to put a counter argument in place, he presents this image of a Christ figure. In this case, it's the elder or starets in the Russian tradition, Zosima. And it's kind of his answer, you know, like that yes, Ivan Karamazov points out that there's all this evil and horribleness in the world. But Dostoevsky also says, yeah, there's this goodness. And this goodness, you know, it finds its fullest manifestation in this person or portrait that is, in some sense, his Christ figure. Mm-hmm. And posing a person as an argument and the reality that there can be embodied goodness, for me, was something I had not really grappled with before. And it speaks to the idea that if, you know, there can be this embodied goodness, you know, it also points deeper to maybe a capital G goodness. That kind of got me rethinking things in a much more fundamental way. You know, I was thinking, well, I can't really buy into a lot of the arguments for this atheism I had embraced. even though I wanted to. And oh, by the way, there is a different way to look at the world and about the reality of goodness, and it's reflected in this Christ figure in the portrait Dostoevsky provides. And oh, by the way, this image of Christianity that I had picked up in kind of the American context that I had felt so uncomfortable with itself doesn't really seem to be historically accurate. So, it took me a while to put all the pieces together, but it feels like that was a point in time. It was probably about 38, 39. So maybe 11, 12 years ago, where I really came to this point of reconsideration and reflection. You know, how did I get from there to Eastern Orthodoxy? It wasn't, what wasn't the case was, let's go look at like quote unquote Russian Christianity or whatever my ethnic background was. In some ways, I think that would have probably been more of a, hey, I'm not interested in something because it's an ethnic thing. I'm interested in trying to figure out like, what is the nature of reality and what does it mean to be a human being? And it can't just be something for Russians or Greeks or, you know, what have you not, right? It was almost accidental in the sense that my grandfather had passed away. A really good man, and I think kind of a model in many ways for just a person that tried to carry himself with dignity. I had a cousin who was Russian Orthodox, who recommended, said I was going out to California so much. She mentioned that she was, when she was out here, she used to go to the Russian Orthodox Cathedral in San Francisco, Holy Virgin Cathedral that's on Geary Street, and just how lovely it was and so forth. So I went to visit the cathedral, and I think it was a Vespers service in the evening in Slavonic, didn't understand a thing. There were maybe two people there plus a priest, in this big cathedral. And, I went in there, I mean, hadn't, you know, in my adult life, I guess, hadn't prayed ever, maybe, certainly not in, you know, probably more than a decade. And just went in there and almost broke down. It was right by the relics of St. John Maximovich, St. John of San Francisco and Shanghai, and just knelt down and prayed to the saint. So it's just so weird for somebody who has no real material background in Orthodoxy, no real material background in, in Catholicism or something that would, you know, have relics and saints that you'd be praying to and so forth. And, next thing I know, I'm sort of there kind of, in this kind of not even emotional state, but just in this state of feeling openness and like there was something materially here, almost magical. And that sort of sent me on the course then of saying, well, maybe I should not only be thinking about these things more deeply from an intellectual perspective, but more also in a in a more personal level. And so that one thing led to another, and, you know, wound up, subsequently getting chrismated and regular participant in, Orthodox life and tradition.
I think that's
kind of the story.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. That's very similar to me when I was younger. That was Dostoevsky, the same book you mentioned that introduced me to the Orthodox Church, actually. When it was right at the beginning, he's contrasting the Rome and Russia, and I'm like, what is this guy talking about, right? And as I go further along, as I read the book, I read him before I discovered the Apostolic Fathers, but it was within like a year of the same time period I discovered both of them. And it was interesting to me because, like you say, the perception of Christianity you had didn't seem like it matched the historical record of Christianity. I was really influenced when I was younger by different occult teachers, right? That's what I was, like Aleister Crowley, Anton LaVey, stuff like that. And Aleister Crowley had this quote, I think, in his Confessions. I think it goes, I never really hated the one true God and the one true Christ, but the God and the Christ are the people I hated, right? And so even the artist Marilyn Manson paraphrased that with the song. And so when you, as you discover historic Christianity, you see it's like what people think is Christianity, what Sam Harris portrayed as Christianity is not what Christianity is at all. So,
yeah, I think, you know, today's the feast of St. Isaac of Syria. And when somebody asks me, like, well, what is this orthodoxy thing and what, how do you look at things? I usually make a reference or send them some of the snippets of writings from St. Isaac, because mm-hmm. they're so, it's just like this embodiment of love and goodness. And, you know, this whole image of God as, you know, God as love. And what are the implications of that? And what does it mean? And, you know, even his image of, you know, heaven and hell is really the experience of God yeah. in the light of that love. You know, it's just a very different thing than I had exposure to.
God is the fire of hell.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, weirdly enough, I was speaking to a friend of mine from college today. And one of the things that we were talking about was St. Isaac. And it's just this, he's like, what do you mean? Like, the heaven and hell are the same thing. And I said, well, it's the revelation of the ultimate reality in the light of truth. And for some people, that's going to be something that will bring joy and peace. And for other people, it'll be something that will be, you know, various degrees of suffering or hardship or torment.
Yeah, this is something that for myself coming, you know, and I didn't even learn this in seminary. Like, I've been a priest for almost 13 years now. And I discovered this later after I was even ordained, where I was reading, especially St. Gregory Palamas, who mm-hmm. very much in line with this kind of thought as well. And you see it in some of the Cappadocians as well, but especially it's developed more later, like in the, you know, 13th, 14th centuries, right? You know, this profound, profound idea of that if God is all in all, like he is omnipresent, it's not like it's been presented to us like in movies and in poetry and things like that, you know, that, you know, heaven and hell are like these physical places that are separate, you know, and that you got the little pitchforks and stuff in the lake of fire and things like that. Of course, we have this poetry, this imagery, which is there mm-hmm. to elicit like a certain kind of a response. But at the same time, theologically, it doesn't work, because then you start, you know, asking questions like, well, if God is everywhere and fills all things, is he the manager of hell as well? Is he stoking the fires? Is he?
There's a great quote from, now saint, the elder Sophroni, who was, I guess, a acolyte or a disciple of St. Siloam in Mount Athos, where he says, I'm paraphrasing, so if I get this slightly wrong, but he was asked a question about, you know, the afterlife and hell and so forth. And he said, that you can rest assured that if there remains a single person in hell, Christ is there with him. And when I read those kinds of things, you know, they were like, they were just a completely different conceptualization of what does it mean to be a Christian? What does salvation mean? You know, what does it mean for this reconciliation of all creation together with God? It really made me step back and rethink things in a fundamental way. And I think, you know, frankly, without a lot of that kind of understanding, I don't know that I would have ever come to a place where I would have returned to or turned to, depending how you look at it, Christianity. Mm-hmm. I don't have a deep background in Catholicism or Western Christianity in general. But I'm not sure that really exists outside of the Eastern tradition, you know, as a kind of understanding and a point of emphasis.
I know apocatastasis is really popular in evangelical circles now, like not the way David Bentley Hart teaches it, right? But more like a enduring love of God. So I don't know where they're getting this from. I know there are, I have some Protestant friends who are theologically trained in the evangelical Protestant tradition. And even I'll see some things they post and, you know, they'll talk about the three ancient classical positions, you know, annihilationism, universalism, and then the dualistic view. So there is knowledge of it there. It's obviously not the most popular one, but I don't know if it's the same way as like Gregory of Nyssa would have talked about it, or Palamas or anything like that. So,
yeah, well, Gregory of Nyssa is my patron saint, so I have to I have to identify with him theologically, I guess you have to say. Yeah. But he has this beautiful vision, you know, is that we move through, you know, we all move through some sort of purgation, but we're on this infinite journey closer and closer to union with God.
Yeah, eternal progression. And,
I find that very compelling. Just frankly, I find it compelling at an emotional level or a moral level, but, intellectually as well. I've always, what got me really interested in philosophy way back when, even as undergraduate, was, Plato. So a lot of the patristic writers that were influenced by Platonism and so forth really resonated with me quite strongly. I've read Dr. Hart's book,
his latest book.
I read most of his books. but I, you know, there's things I disagree with him on in his writings. And his style can be a little abrasive. Yeah. his last book on I'll butcher the Greek, but let me say
universal salvation.
Apokatastasis. Is that?
Yeah.
I can never get the syllables right in long Greek words. It's like,
it took me, I'm not a Greek, I'm Greek Orthodox, but it's so, so it takes me a while to learn to pronounce things, but yeah, it's, he's definitely got people talking, whether you like him or you don't like him. He's got people in the church and outside the church, believers, non-believers, talking about religion, specifically Christianity, in a way that other theologians aren't. Because unfortunately, in the Orthodox Church, most people just care about ethnicity, and that includes clergy. And that's just the reality, unfortunately. So when people want to say bad things about him, it's like, well, what are you doing to draw people to the church? Most people aren't doing too much.
Yeah, I think one thing, and you guys may disagree, you're the trained in theology, I'm not, but one thing that struck me with Orthodoxy over the years is, there's this very rich liturgical tradition, and it's very iconographic, so to speak, a lot of images that kind of point us and teach us. When it comes down to it, somebody asked me one time, well, what do you actually have to believe? And when I stopped back and thought about it, I'm like, well, you don't actually... Like there are many theologies in the Orthodox Church, and it's this idea of theologumenons, that you have theological opinions, but they're not binding. That seems to, in some ways that I think frustrates people that, you don't have every answer for everything. And it's like, well, we have an answer for how to orient your life toward Christ. Mm-hmm. And everything else there is a pointer toward Christ and toward orienting your life in that direction. And they're not there to, give you a third order scholastic dogmatic answer to obscure questions. They're there as, guideposts in a sense. And I know I've heard people, express frustration, or say things like, well, how can you not have an answer that, you can say 100% correct? And I'm like, well, I think I've come to a point where I'm like, well, that's not what it is. And that's not what it's there for. Mm-hmm. It's there for us to build an orientation and a relationship, and it really point us on a pathway, on a journey that perhaps is an infinite, never ending journey.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, when we're talking about metaphysics, we're talking about the divine, it would be disingenuous and suspect if you had an answer to everything, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how could you, just by the nature of God being God, right? And like, and us being like the created, how could we? And so, and that's one of the big arguments, I guess you could say, or criticisms of not only atheists, but like, non-Christians or people who are generally critical about religion. It's like this idea that, these religious people, they pretend they know everything about everything and they have an answer for everything.
Because some do, apparently. I don't know.
but this is also like a product of, it is not an East versus West thing, but there is kind of a different mentality in the West. There's kind of this scholastic approach, right? And so I always like say, if you pick up like the average Orthodox catechism book, right? And you pick up the Roman Catholic catechism book. Well, there are some dogmatic Orthodox books that are heavily influenced by the West and they're pretty thick, but generally mm-hmm. Most Orthodox basic dogmatic books are very thin. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Roman Catholic Catechism, it's like 1700 pages, right? I have it. it's like, oh, it's right there. and it's, it's just article upon article upon article. So you know, and I remember a quote from Father Andrew Stephen Damick. I don't know if you know Orthodoxy and Heterodoxy.
Yeah, sure.
So he had a really nice quote in his podcast, in his initial podcast on Orthodoxy and Heterodoxy, when he said, Orthodoxy never purports to know the complete truth about anything, but it only knows, like, you know, it only delineates the border of the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So Orthodoxy is predominantly experiential and mystical, and you have to basically jump in and experience it. And there's profound spiritual depth there, but it's not things that you can write down in a book. And so, you know, yeah, like you said, the basic things you need to know are not many. It's basically the creed, right?
Yeah. I mean, literally there's creedal affirmations about largely about Christ and Christ and how Christological elements relate to God.
And that's it.
And, the rest of it is, you know, you're on this path, you're on this journey, and, you know, it's, I think, a beautiful thing, really. The, you know, in this, in Saint Paul, right? I mean, he makes the point that we don't really see much of we see dimly, you know, and ultimately we'll see God face to face and everything will be revealed. But that's, maybe not for us, at the present time.
Sure. I got a question. Were you married? Like, obviously you were married during these different periods of your life. I think you alluded to that earlier, right? When you're non-religious, you're atheistic period.
And, yeah.
And then, so how did your wife deal with the both ends?
I think, we were married. It was a civil marriage. There wasn't any religious element to it. And, you know, when my daughter was born, you know, off and on, I think my wife wanted to take her to church services of some sort. But, you know, I was pretty clear that whatever we did, I wasn't really interested in it personally. And that, you know, I wanted her to have something more like a secular upbringing at the time. So I think the pivot point was probably more surprising. Well, it was pretty surprising to me, but it may have been more surprising for her than anyone else. Which was, you know, and she, her family background, her mother was, you know, in an independent Baptist church, a wonderful woman, just an exemplar of just a very simple, but very pure faith. I don't associate that with the independent Baptist churches, but she, you know, she read the scriptures. She tried to do what, she felt that, you know, the commandments of Christ were instructing her to do. And she really lived that. Just a really wonderful, beautiful, non-judgmental woman. She had a big influence on me as well. Because as I started to reflect on these things and started to think about her and her personality and her own personal relationship with Christ, it had a big impact actually on my entry or really even receptivity to looking at Orthodoxy. But I do think, you know, my wife has been on this journey as well. So eventually we were, I won't say remarried. We were crowned.
Oh, you're crowned, yeah.
Church, and, she's now teaches Sunday school, or, you know, an arts and crafts thing at our local parish. I should mention our parish. I go to St. Michael's, St. Michael, the Archangel in, Concord, California. So great small parish, but great little place. We're having a hard time with the COVID situation because California's been pretty strict.
Mm-hmm.
Really just great community of people, different ethnicities, different groups. Services are in English. Our priest or pastor is a convert from Roman Catholicism. He was a Roman Catholic priest for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And then became Orthodox. You know, within the last three or four years. So it's a pretty interesting melting pot. People from just all kinds of different traditions, different places, and, you know, just sort of all coming together for the liturgy and you know, service to the community. Nice.
thank you, Greg, for that wonderful background on your journey. It's a fascinating journey, and I knew that Father Thomas was going to be interested in it because, like, I knew that he also had a connection with Brothers Karamazov and Dostoevsky, and a very similar experience. So I'm like, oh my goodness, when you wrote that to me, yesterday or a couple of days ago, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Like, what are the odds of two people coming on this podcast and they both had a pivotal moment in their journey to Orthodoxy through Dostoevsky, which I suspect Dostoevsky has played a role in many people's pivotal journeys.
Yeah. Pivotal moments. Yeah, I think so. Dostoevsky painted as a kind of the human psychologist par excellence. So I think no matter where you come from or where you wind up, he can be a very impactful thinker.
Sure. Well, having said that, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your jiu-jitsu journey, because again, this podcast is all about mashing up together, you know, the Orthodox and the jiu-jitsu, because, you know, both of us do it as priests, but of course, whether we're lay people or clergy, it doesn't make a difference. It's our contention in this podcast that, you know, jiu-jitsu's values and, you know, kind of the lifestyle that kind of follows along with that is heavily in line with kind of like the ascetic approach that Orthodoxy demands of its adherence. And I want to hear a little bit about how you got into jiu-jitsu. You know, when did you get into it? Did you get into it later in your life, early in your life? And how has that journey kind of progressed?
Yeah. I fell into jiu-jitsu completely accidentally. When I was in my late 20s, second half of my 20s, I had lived in Colorado and just super active outside, did a lot of mountain biking and mountaineering, rock climbing. I'm just constantly out doing stuff. And at the time, that was sort of the vibe in Colorado. You know, if you're out there, you're going to be taking advantage of the mountains. And so that's what I did. And I wound up taking a job and moving back to New Jersey, South Jersey, which was close to where I had lived and gone to high school. And I got there and, South Jersey's got good things about great Italian food, close to the ocean. And there's, outdoor stuff you can do, for sure. There's fishing, hunting, that kind of thing. But I was just really used to this physically active stuff. And after I got there, I actually started getting a little depressed. I'm like, oh, all the things I really was passionate about, I can't do. It's all flat and sandy. There's no mountains. There's no climbing. And I happened to, and this is dating me quite a bit, but I happened to go to West Coast Video and got one of the VHS rentals of the first UFC. Yeah. So it's probably within a couple years of UFC coming out. And didn't know anything about it, didn't have any expectations, watched it, and this, skinny little Brazilian guy, Royce Gracie, proceeds to just beat everybody, drags him to the ground and chokes him out. And, I just was like, whoa, that was really kind of something I hadn't expected. And then I think I watched the second one. I went back and read another one, and he runs through everybody again, and it kept happening, and I was like, how is this even possible? So I had no martial arts background, no strong interest in fighting per se or anything like that. But I thought, well, I'm looking for something to do. I'm looking for something physical. Maybe I'll check this out. So I found a place in the Yellow Pages, pre-internet days, in Philadelphia. Maxercise, which was a place owned by Steve Maxwell.
Yeah.
So Steve, he probably won't remember me, but Steve had a gym there, and he was, I think, a four-stripe purple belt at the time under Hoyce and Horian. So he was, part of that Gracie thing. So I started to go once a week and did it for 2 years, mostly gi training. I got my blue belt, the single stripe, my blue belt.
Got your blue belt from Steve Maxwell?
Steve Maxwell, and Phil Miglerice, who owns Balance in Philly now. So Phil's still under Helsing Gracie, and I don't know, he's got like six stripes on his black belt or something like that. Great guy. Steve was a great instructor, but I went kind of slow and steady, and then life just kind of got busy, and going over to Philly because it was a 45-minute-hour drive each way, it got less and less reasonable. So I kind of dropped out after a couple of years. And I kind of like missed it, but didn't really think about it much. And then in my mid-40s, I had a bout with thyroid cancer. And after I went through the treatment, I had thyroidectomy and then this whole nuclear medicine thing, I was pretty beat down. Like, I mean, to the point where I couldn't even bend over and tie my shoes. I wasn't in great shape to begin with. But that was like taking like the mediocre, you know, shape and like driving me down to like, if I don't do something, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So, this time I didn't go to the phone book. I was trying to think what would get me back in shape and what did I enjoy doing? So I went on the internet and I just looked up local Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and, up the road from me about 10, 15 minutes, there was 10 Planet. Place. And so that was 10 Planet Walnut Creek. You know, I went and got completely crushed. I, you know, within like a few minutes of like trying to get back into rolling after the regular class, you know, I cotton mouth and, you know, had gotten tapped out by like 14-year-olds and stuff. And it was all this new no gi and crazy moves and all that. I had no idea what was going on. But I did my free class, and I thanked the instructor, my coach Alex, and went home and told my wife, got my backside kicked. And you know, she's like, "Well, what'd you think?" And I said, "I'm signing up and I'm going back." So a few days later, I show back up, and Alex, I walk in, I still remember this day, looks at me and he goes, "Oh, you're back." So and I've been, you know, modulo injuries. I've been going 3 or 4 times a week, sometimes more, sometimes less, you know, just depends on work and travel and all that ever since. So I've been at it for about 5.5 years there.
So how old are you when you started 10th Planet?
I was probably 45. I'm in year 50 now. So is it 44 or 45, somewhere in that range. You know, there's some like... There are some things in 10th Planet in particular that like the rubber guard stuff requires some flexibility. A lot of it's angles. I think that's
when you open up your hip and learn how to use your hips.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do try to do stretching. I try to do some yoga. Not enough, honestly. I think if I were like really disciplined every day, I'd have quite a bit more hip flexibility. You know, I mean, all my training partners are younger. During COVID, we're stuck. So we have a pod we set up. So there's a couple other guys that I train with 3 or 4 times a week that are also in pretty strict lockdown. But high-level purple belts. One guy, frankly, might as well get his black belt because he's just killing it. You know, they're younger guys. So they're like, when I look at them, you know, it's like 10, 15, you know, or more years younger, but you know, I do fine.
Greg, I'm 39 and everybody I roll with is younger too.
Yeah. It only gets worse.
By 10, 15 years. Like there's very few guys who are like my age, like at the club. Right. So it's, I know.
Yeah. I find, you know, the only issue for me really, to be honest, is maybe a little bit on the speed side, but for the most part, my cardio needs a lot of work to keep pace with things with the real young guys. You know, they just have it. I don't. So I do try to, you know, I do pretty long, pretty grueling mountain bike rides every week and do some, you know, inside stuff on a stationary bike and try to keep the cardio going. I lift every other day, and I do try to do stretching or yoga routines as well. Yeah, the cardio part is my biggest. And I competed quite a bit when I first started with Alex. I went through a whole series of injuries. I had surgery on both knees. I broke my elbow, had to have my tricep and elbow, tricep joint below the elbow kind of reconstructed. And, you know, I've torn my LCL. Ground up one of the knees a second time. So I've gone through a bunch of injuries this time around, which I never had when I was younger. I did the first time I did it. You know, I just, you know, I lose some time, come back, build the cardio back. I competed last year, end of 2020, did pretty well. one of the guys, I had two opponents. We did a whole bunch of matches. One guy did quite well against was former pro MMA guy, Bellator fighter, and also a 10th Planet brown belt. So managed to catch him a couple times and felt good about that. And then I went against one of the instructors at 10th Planet San Mateo and got pretty crushed. So I felt bad about that. But my excuse was he was younger. They're both younger. So, you know, I really play it up that are younger if I get the tap, and if I get tapped, then I'm like, yeah, he's younger.
Well, it's okay. The ego got boosted, and then you got
exactly. Well, that goes back to your thing about orthodoxy. There is something about crucifying the ego. Jiu-jitsu helps with, for sure. I would, in fact, that both jiu-jitsu and orthodoxy are definitely tools to keep you grounded in reality. I mean, just from a practical perspective, because they can both teach you that, you know, your own inflated sense of self is effectively a false, idol. That was kind of the jiu-jitsu story, how I get into it. And so I prior to COVID, I was teaching. I taught a Friday morning class. Mm-hmm. And tried to keep that pretty much, you know, consistent regularly, which helped me quite a bit. I mean, having to break things down and explain things, mm-hmm. And then answer people's questions, it definitely pushes you to a deeper level of understanding. And then also exposes holes you have that you then have to go figure out, like, what's going on with that. The other thing is there's just a lot of jiu-jitsu out here and a lot of high level guys. The Bay Area's got really good guys, like Denny's in the city. Jake Shields is over there. Alex is great. We've got, Kyo Terra down in San Jose with Yuri Samoas. The place in Dublin, the MMA place that does a lot of UFC, trains a lot of UFC fighters. So there's a lot of good guys up here. I guess there's probably bigger density in Southern California, probably, but I used to have to travel down Southern California for business too. So I'd always do drop-ins at gyms down that way as well. But the good thing about it is nobody has any problem. You can train wherever you want. And, you know, especially with the 10 Planet stuff, it's just assumed that you're going to do jiu-jitsu, right? It doesn't matter where you do it or who you do it with. And then with the 10 Planet schools too, we would all just train. You could go train somewhere for, you don't have to pay a drop in fee. So I would go over and train with Denny, when I had a chance, and, you know, you get different perspective, different, you know, take on technique and approach and body types and emphasis. That's been helpful. And then Alex does a lot of, whenever somebody's coming through, you know, he'll have them come and run a seminar at the gym. So I've gotten a chance. A lot of the top level guys in 10th Planet I've had a chance to train with, both here and then at their gyms when I've traveled. Gio Martinez, Richie Martinez, those guys are great. Great guys, but also great up in 10th Planet Portland with Nathan Orchard and Phil Schwartz. I do sometimes do the boot camps they run. So I've gotten a lot of good guys there. Tom DeBlass, Dean Lister. And all these guys have different perspective and usually super open to just spending time answering your questions and working with you. Jeff Glover. You know, my deep half position was like a complete dead zone for me maybe a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. 2 years ago. I've trained with Jeff a bunch of times on it personally. Plus, now that we're in COVID especially, I've been using a lot of the BJJ Fanatics DVDs and series. And so now it's like a go-to thing for me. Like, I'm doing it all the time. Just last night I was over at my friend's garage, one of the guys in the pod, and we were training for a couple hours. And I had to say I had a beautiful deep half sweep because he knows all the counters. He knows exactly what I'm going to do. And, you know, he's gotten really, really good at trying to shut it down. So when I felt him doing what I knew he was going to do to shut it down, I was able to kind of pull up some tricks I got off of Jeff and pulled the sweep off pretty cleanly. So I felt good about that.
When did you get your purple belt?
I think, if I recall correctly, it was the end of 2015. So it was, you know, just about 5 years ago. I had won Jiu-Jitsu by the Bay, one of the local tournaments. I had won the expert division in the, you know, above 40 bracket or something like that. And, you know, in all fairness, the other guy was, I don't know, he was either a blue belt or a new purple belt. He was a nice guy, but wasn't that great. But, you know, I guess coming off of winning the expert division, I guess that merited the belt promotion. I was surprised and frankly didn't think I deserved it at the time. Now I feel okay with the purple belt. So that's like, I feel like then I was just sort of feeling good about being a blue belt, and especially
in the more, right?
Yeah. So now I feel good about being a purple belt. So must mean the brown belt somewhere on the horizon. I don't know.
Oh yeah, five years at purple, yeah. So
yeah.
Yeah, Father Thomas was saying that in a previous podcast where it's like we were discussing, you know, what happens when you get promoted and you don't feel like you deserve it. And it's like, just accept it gracefully. And if you don't think you're there, you just got to work harder to work into it or train into that level, you know, just try to work to honor it. Right. So,
yeah, I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. Like when you get the promotion, you know, it's the starting point. It's definitely not the end. And I, you know, I think that the thing for me, even over the last year or so, I feel like I'm just starting to like get jiu-jitsu. Like I'm finally starting to understand, not like there's a bunch of moves or, you know, I'm going to take advantage of unforced errors. Like to really, now I have this completely different concept of like, how do I approach the problem? And now my focus is on forcing people to make errors, not unforced errors, right? So that you can go up against good people that know what they're doing and still have a chance of, you know, coming out on top. And also much more principle oriented than either moves or submission. You need to know moves and submissions, but what are the principles that, you know, that make those moves and submissions work? And what are the principles especially that apply in transitions? Because that's what builds a real game. So, you know, I feel like I'm finally like, the blinders have come off the eyes and I'm seeing like, oh my God, I didn't really know jiu-jitsu. Like I thought I did. Now I'm starting to understand that there's this.
Yeah.
There's
wait till you get your brown belt and it happens again. You'll be like, oh, now I know.
Yeah. It makes me feel a little better now. It's like a two-stripe white belt, you know, it's like, oh, by purple belt, I'll start figuring out. That's good. It makes me feel a little better about not understanding anything right now.
Yeah. Well, my coach Alex said the same thing. So when I started with him, he was a brown belt, and he was in like a rented space in a CrossFit gym and all that. And you know, I think it was about a year after that he got his black belt and got his own gym and all his own space. So that's been transformative. But he, you know, even over the last few years, he said to me several times, like, I'm just starting to get it. Like, it's like, I'm just starting out on my jiu-jitsu journey, which is a pretty cool thing to hear from somebody who's, you know, already like a one stripe black belt, that they're like, and he's, you know, he's competed in worlds and all over the place and done really well. So to hear him say like, it's all sort of, you know, a series of getting these insights and inspirations on how to think differently about the problem. It was important, I think, for me to also understand that there's a lot here that you don't know, but that's okay. Like that's a sign that you actually are learning more, that you know more, to recognize what you don't know. Some like, it's like apophatic theology. So it's another jiu-jitsu orthodoxy connection.
So coming into our final thoughts now, you know, we could talk all day with you, Greg. We're really enjoying this podcast, but, you know, there always has to be a time to end. And so we always have our section on final thoughts here on our podcast. And you just, you know, you just said something really interesting about apophatic theology, right? It's like, you know, in the Orthodox faith, we do have this idea of, you know, the more you know about God, the less you know, because God is infinite and God is beyond, you know, any type of human understanding. And so just when we think we know something, we realize we actually just realize more of what we don't know, or how little we are compared to God. And I noticed that you were kind of describing the exact same thing in your jiu-jitsu journey. Like, you know, it's like I get to like purple belt and I think I know nothing, right? I'm just like, now things are just, you know, starting to make sense now. And then Father Thomas said, well, when you get to brown belt, it'll be the same thing. It's like shifting into another gear. As one of my friends always tells me at the club, you know, you shift into a new gear and now it's like a whole new world and you forget about everything you thought you knew, because now it's a completely different ball game. So I don't know, like, perhaps you can tell us your thoughts about that, or your final thoughts about, you know, this kind of journey that you've had, this incredible journey, you know, coming back to your faith, because, you know, kind of your background was from Orthodoxy, even though you didn't really grow up active in it, you know, coming full circle, and how that has kind of affected your, like, or has it affected your jiu-jitsu journey? You know, like, have they been running parallel, or are they, you know, two different things?
Yeah, I mean, they are running parallel, and they are two different things, but I think I had made the connection several years back about this idea that you have to crucify the ego and you have to put aside illusions of, or delusions of grandeur, or this sort of false self that we all create, as a part of the spiritual path in Orthodoxy and as a part of like your survival in jiu-jitsu. So there had been that registered to me that there was something interconnected between those two worlds that maybe even fed on each other. I'd say, and this was a spontaneous thing to mention, the apophatic theology, but the more I think about what I've gone through in both spiritual journey and in a jiu-jitsu journey, there is an analogy that's pretty strong there, because, you know, again, like, I like to read, I like to think about, you know, theology and arguments and philosophy. And so part of like kind of moving it through a conversion stage, it's like you're reading all this stuff, you're discovering it, and you're like, oh, I got all these answers, right? And I can explain all this stuff, and this is, you know, a system. But then I came to realize in Orthodoxy, it's actually not that way. Like, you have to let those things are like idols. You have to let them go. Like, you know, the point isn't to win an argument or show you're right. The point is to change your life, you know, and to grow closer to God and Christ, right? And I think that, you know, Orthodoxy parallels that whole, that, or jiu-jitsu parallels that with Orthodoxy, in the sense that, you know, you have to not only let go of your ego, but you're not going to make progress unless you recognize that you don't have the answers. And the more you get insights into what works and what carries you forward, the more it opens up this whole vista of things you don't know, that you have to move closer to discovering and approaching differently. And that probably, I don't know which one was harder, you know, to learn and harder to accept. But there is, in some ways, you know, this recognition that no matter how far you travel, you still have this infinite expanse of journey ahead of you, which also keeps them both quite fresh and exciting in their own ways, because there's, you know, you're growing, but your growth is showing you how much more you have to grow.
Yeah.
And I think for people in general, you know, no one wants to be static, you know, and stuck in a spot, and, you know, everyone, I think if you don't have meaning in life and a path to move forward, you know, leads to despair, you know, can lead to personal disaster. So I think, for me at least, that on both axes of, you know, Orthodoxy and jiu-jitsu, there's been this recognition that, you know, there's never going to be an end in the journey, and that's actually a good thing.
From glory to glory.
Yep. Yep.
Right. Yeah. Father Thomas, any thoughts?
You know me, no final thoughts. I thank Greg that he came on the show, and I think it's really interesting that some of the things that influenced you influenced me as well on my journey to the church. And I'm sure, I know there's many, many people more that the Apostolic Fathers and Dostoevsky have influenced a lot of people, and I encourage everyone who hasn't read those to read them.
Yeah. And, you know, Father Thomas, we've said this before too, you have like also a unique experience, because you have this literally a parallel journey, right? Like, yeah. You know, when Father Thomas got baptized Orthodox, it was the same year he started jujitsu, right?
And oh, wow.
Over a decade ago. So he has this interesting point of view that not a lot of people have, where you're coming into both jujitsu and Orthodoxy as an adult, you know, kind of, you know what you're getting into, and you're kind of taking, you know, this journey. It's almost like two friends, you know? And that's very unique. Like my experience is the opposite. Mine is retroactive because I've been a priest for like, well, when I started jujitsu, almost 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm cradle Orthodox, you know, we use that term, right? I'm born into an Orthodox family and baptized as an infant. So, you know, but even in the priesthood, it's like I've been doing that for over a decade, but only now, about a year and a half now, I've been doing jujitsu. And now is my aha moment. Now it's like, oh, it's like the apostles, you know, you're retroactively reinterpreting the Old Testament, right? Well, I'm like retroactively reinterpreting. I'm not even joking about this. I'm retroactively reinterpreting my priesthood in the light of jujitsu, which I know can sound completely ridiculous to Orthodox Christians maybe listening to this, but it's been an eye opener for me. Like a lot of things that I thought I understood about humility, about asceticism, we can read all the books in the world, but yeah. Until you get on the mat and you get choked out, like you said, by like 14 different people in a row, you realize that, yeah, you are nothing, right? You know nothing. And that's a really healthy thing, I think, for Orthodox priests to realize or to be reminded of in ministry, but also generally Orthodox Christians to remind themselves, like, you know, if we say we're humble, but saying it and actually really internalizing it is two different things, right?
Yep. Yeah, no, as much as I love books and they played an important part of my life, you know, that they, you can build up a lot of illusions in your mind that life itself will break down for you. And I think, you know, both Orthodoxy and jujitsu are great ways to help break that down.
Yeah.
I always say, like somebody asked me, what is it about Orthodoxy that appeals to you or appealed to you originally or appeals to you still? And my answer is always that Orthodoxy, in my understanding, is really coming to terms with ultimate reality. What is it? What is ultimate reality, and what does it mean to be a human being in the light of ultimate reality? And you know, that's that insight and that gift of understanding is not something you're born with. I think it's something you have to learn and search for and strive for and work for. And clearly, with the jujitsu, you have to. We're not born with that either. Got to work for it, strive for it, and earn it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Greg, thank you very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on the podcast. We really, really enjoyed it. I know I did. I know Father Thomas already said that he really enjoyed talking with you. We hope to have you on again.
Okay, great. Yeah, and if either you or both of you are out in California, you know, come by to our parish, come by to the gym.
We're already planning, you know, it's like we keep saying when the law, you know, when this whole thing is over, we're going to do a road trip.
You know? Okay. All right. Well, California, California has good things, bad things about it, but the jiu-jitsu scene here is quite good.
Right. Yeah. That's what we keep hearing. So we hope to get out there one day in the near future and see everybody and maybe roll. And until then, you know, God bless you. Be safe. And we hope to see you again soon.
Okay. Thank you, fathers.
Take care.
You have been listening to the Fighting Priests, an independent podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram and let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. Till next time, keep training the body and the soul. God bless.